So those are my comments, my opening remarks, and I would like to get on to our wonderful course of speakers that we have for this conference. I'm so delighted with every one of them has agreed to be here. Our first speaker, I will say, there's some that may, that we're expecting Robert George to be here, and he did have to cancel not too long ago, but we were able to get a really superb replacement, more than a fill-in. So Ross Douthat agreed to come on very short notice, and we were very happy to see that. Now, I've seen his name so many times because people forward me, you know, articles by him, and I see his books, and I've read much of him and his commentary. I always find it extremely helpful, very considered, insightful, and, you know, wedded to the tradition. So I'm very pleased to have him with us tonight for our first address. If you don't know him, he's a columnist for the New York Times op-ed page. He is the author of To Change the Church, Privilege, and Grand New Party, and also Bad Faith. Before joining the New York Times, he was a senior editor for The Atlantic. He is the film critic for National Review, and he's appeared regularly on television, including Charlie Rose, PBS NewsHour, and Real Time with Bill Maher. Now, that should be an interesting story in itself, but we won't go into that. But please welcome Ross Douthat.
Thank you. I'm just going to set my phone here, not because I'm at all addicted to it, but in order to remind me when to finish up so I don't monopolize too much of the evening. Thank you all so much for being here. Thank you for that very kind introduction. I apologize for not being Professor Robert George. I've been apologizing for that to my wife and others for many years now. I will say that unlike Professor George, perhaps later in the Q&A, I can tell you stories about hanging out with Demi Moore and Ashton Kutcher in the green room on Bill Maher's show. So if you want, if you can find a theological direction to take a question about that issue, I'm happy to address all related matters. So I figured I should start the conversations that all of you are going to be hearing and having this weekend by trying to do two things. Give you an overview of what I think is the broad religious context in which debates about books like my friend Rod's The Benedict Option and other options are taking place, and then try and strike, and maybe not an optimistic note, but a semi-optimistic note. I think there will be occasionally some pessimism on offer here and there in this conversation. There usually is. So I'm going to try and strike a note that gestures at least some possibilities for thinking about ways in which the present religious landscape in the United States and in the West more broadly offers real opportunities for Christian witness and evangelization, and maybe multiple options for doing both. So let's start with a sketch of where we are. I think one useful way to think about the religious landscape today is to think about where is the American religious center? Obviously, there could be multiple religious centers. We're a nation of 300 million people with all the tangled complexity that that implies, but I think you can tell a story where if you go back, let's say, 20 years before Roe v. Wade, when you were 12, I guess, rather than, and I was six, maybe a little younger than that. If you go back three generations in American life, go back to the 1950s, you would have said reasonably, I think, that although America had a sort of secular and skeptical intelligentsia, or at least a partially secular and skeptical intelligentsia, and although American religion was filled, as it always is, with a certain sweep of hucksters and flim-flam artists and religious entrepreneurs on the make, for all that, you would also look at the American religious landscape then and say there was a kind of real ecumenical Christian center in which it was possible to take figures from different serious Christian traditions, place them into dialogue with one another, and say that a religious center existed somewhere within that dialogue and the lines that ran between them. So if you think of representative figures from that era, I'll just pick four who I think are useful from different branches of Christendom. First, a figure like, from my own Catholic Church, a figure like Fulton Sheen, the famous radio and television bishop who delivered talks and quasi-sermons and advice and lectures and so on in prime time in a full pre-Vatican II bishop's regalia with the pectoral cross and all the rest, and who was essentially, if you imagine, you know, Dr. Phil, but a trad. That's basically, I mean, I'm exaggerating a bit, but that's, you know, that in contemporary terms, that gives you a bit of the flavor of Fulton Sheen's place in the culture. And then alongside him, you could set a figure like Reinhold Niebuhr, the famous Protestant theologian who graced the cover of Time magazine and was seen as sort of a great sage of the moral landscape of the post-World War II era, and who represented a turn within the intellectual life and spiritual life of his Protestant world towards what was then called neo-orthodoxy, basically an attempt at sort of the recovery of Christian traditions by Protestant churches that had maybe strayed a bit too far towards a certain form of utopianism in the 1920s and 1930s. So you have a Sheen, and then you have a Niebuhr, and then you have a figure like Billy Graham, the great evangelist who brought evangelical Christianity out of the stereotypes of the Scopes trial and the fundamentalist backwoods revival, and demonstrated that you could be an evangelical preacher and draw huge crowds to New York City and Chicago and get favorable write-ups in newspapers like the New York Times. It's worth going back and reading how the Times wrote about Graham's revivals in the 1950s. Not that anything's changed since then, of course. So you have Graham, and then you have a figure like Martin Luther King, who represents sort of the emergence of African American Christianity, long one of the most pious and fervent, but also marginalized and oppressed portions of American Christianity, into a role as, in effect, the Christian conscience of the nation. So in those figures, again, they all had their differences. Niebuhr was probably not a particular fan of Graham, and Graham and King had a complicated relationship in the early days of the civil rights movement, so there wasn't some perfect happy ecumenism there between them, but there was, I think, a world where you could look at figures like that and say there was a kind of convergence between different Christian traditions, which were serious, which were undergirded by demographic growth in the post-World War II revival, and seemed to suggest a kind of mere Christian, to use C.S. Lewis, another figure of the time, another Time magazine cover figure from the time, to use his phrase, a kind of mere Christian center for American religious life. Jump forward to our own era, and what is the equivalent center? And I think instead of four people, I'll just simplify and reduce it to two people. I think replace Fulton Sheen and Billy Graham with Joel Osteen and Oprah Winfrey, and you have the shift in what constitutes the American religious center from that era to this one. And note, you know, neither Osteen nor Winfrey are in any way secular figures. They are deeply spiritual figures, and they're religious figures. Osteen obviously pastors a church. Winfrey hosts what are sort of effectively spiritual revival sessions around the country with different authors and figures and spiritual gurus, including our future president, Marianne Williamson. And between them, you can see Oprah as a little bit more of a blue state and sort of female-coded figure, and Osteen as a little more of a red state and male-coded figure. So it gets at sort of the complexities. There isn't a simple center. It's complicated and diverse, as it was in the 50s, but it's very different. It's less theologically serious. It's less rooted in specific traditions, specific churches. And it's much more of a sort of individualized and consumerized form of religion. And I think the best way to think about to sort of start from that center and then think about the broader change, is that the US in the 1940s and 50s had a bunch of big, different Christian religious traditions, Protestant and Catholic, evangelical and mainline, white and African American, that were all reasonably describable as historically Christian, small o Orthodox forms of religious faith. And they feuded with each other and sometimes hated each other, and the Catholic family might not want its daughter to marry a Lutheran and vice versa. But compared to the landscape of today, in the hindsight that we get when we look back on history, they seem to have a great deal in common. Whereas today, I think it's worth thinking about American religion as divided into three big groups, three big traditions, three big categories, which do not at all map onto those old denominational and ecclesiological divides. The first tradition or category I would describe as the secular category, which is basically the secularism that existed and has always existed in various ways in American history, but that has expanded its reach and influence to the point where a large swath of sort of the commanding heights of American culture, the entertainment industries and publishing industries, the great newspapers and universities and so on, are seen as, if not completely, mostly secularized, and have adopted or embraced or sort of stumbled towards a worldview that is not anti-religious, not really anti-Christian in this sort of strict sense of a Richard Dawkins. It's not, you know, people who have sort of fully embraced the new atheism or a kind of Jacobin anti-clericalism. Rather, it's people who might be somewhat interested in religion, might have fond feelings towards religion's role in certain liberal political causes of the past, and might even be open to certain religious ideas, provided that they can be dressed in the language of science and the material world. So you might be interested in Buddhist meditation traditions in this secular sphere, if you can be persuaded that the latest research into neuroscience or brain chemistry shows that meditation practices are a good idea. But what this world picture, and this world picture also retains a strongly moralistic sense, I think inherited pretty clearly from Christianity and from often more liberal forms, sort of social gospel forms of Christianity, that undergirds its commitments to egalitarianism and human rights, or at least certain human rights. But this perspective draws the line and draws a pretty strict line at anything too supernatural, too metaphysical, and certainly anything that smacks of revelation. Maybe it would consider some sort of vague clockmaker deity as an intellectual hypothesis to be tossed around, but the idea that God answers prayer or that miracles are real is simply out of bounds. That's the secular world picture. The next world picture is the one that I just described with Joel Osteen and Oprah Winfrey. And it sometimes gets described in journalism and other places as people who are spiritual but not religious. But I think that's actually a useful in a way, but also totally wrong way of looking at it, because it is a religious mentality. Oprah Winfrey is a religious figure. Joel Osteen is a religious figure. Eckhart Tolle, Deepak Chopra, if you go down the list of people who crowd the spirituality section of your local Barnes & Noble or on Amazon, these are religious figures. They are offering and teaching and practicing religious ideas. What is rejected is not religion, it's not the supernatural, it's not the possibility that angels exist, it's not even the divinity of Christ. What's rejected by this center is the idea of authority. It's the idea that there might be a binding revelation or a binding tradition. It's the idea of a magisterium in the Catholic context or sola scriptura in the Protestant context. And it's rejected in favor of a highly American and therefore highly individualized approach to faith, in which you might be part of a congregation, you might be part of a church, you might be in a tradition, but you don't submit to it. You don't consider it something outside yourself that you need to submit yourself to. And the book that I like to cite as sort of the Augustine's Confessions for this religious center is Elizabeth Gilbert's Eat, Pray, Love, which was also a movie with Julia Roberts. The book is better. And the book is really interesting. It's, as its title suggests, a journey through Italy, India, and Bali, by a highly educated upper middle class American journalist who has a dark night of the soul, a sort of classic spiritual crisis that leads her to leave her husband and go on a kind of global quest, which ends up having an incredibly strong religious element. She ends up in an ashram in India having ecstatic religious experiences. And there's nothing, it's not at all like the secular world picture. It takes for granted that the divine might exist. It takes for granted that prayer and meditation might actually put you in touch with some higher cosmic reality. But there's no possibility, it's not even really considered throughout the book, that this might be a story of conversion. It's not a story where Elizabeth Gilbert goes to India, has experiences in an ashram, and becomes a Hindu, or considers Buddhism, or becoming Sikh, or any other sort of Eastern tradition. And it's certainly not a story where she goes to Rome and considers becoming Catholic. She just eats pasta in Rome. And it ends with her finding love again in the arms of a handsome Brazilian divorcee in Bali. And so the story is one, on the one hand, that's rich with authentic spiritual yearning and real recognizable spiritual experience, but one that sort of assumes that all of that experience is something that is all about finding the divine within yourself, the God within, and that religious traditions are useful only insofar as they're sort of cabinets of curiosities that contain interesting objects that you might pull down and use on your own spiritual quest, but they're not rooms or buildings that you would enter into and permanently remain. And that's sort of, in certain ways, it's an extreme case because there are obviously lots of people in this sort of muddled American religious center who don't go on globe-trotting quests and don't find love with handsome Brazilian divorcees and so on, and don't make a whole career on the Oprah lecture circuit afterward. And there are lots of people in this sort of middle category who would identify more explicitly as Christians or with a particular religious tradition than Gilbert does. But I still think her book sort of distills the presiding spirit of this religious center, which is a spirit that basically thinks that the world might indeed be as enchanted as Christianity has always argued that it is, but that the only guide through that enchantment is the one that you find within yourself, and no scripture or authority is worth submitting to fully for that guidance. And then the third group is the one to which I presume most of you belong, which is a tradition that includes multiple traditions. Most of them Christian, but I think you would reasonably put Orthodox Judaism, Mormonism, parts of Islam, and so on in this category as well. And it's the sort of, you could call it the scriptural tradition, you could call it the biblical tradition if you wanted to confine it to Christianity. But either way, it's those Americans who belong to a religious tradition and attempt to conform themselves to the tradition rather than conforming the tradition to themselves. So perhaps then it might just be useful to call this zone traditionalism. And this zone is a zone that feels, I think, for understandable reasons, rather beleaguered these days. I think, if you look at the history of sort of trends in American religion since the 1960s, you see what you might call a sort of shock and then an aftershock. The shock happens in the 60s and 70s. The aftershock has happened in the last 10 or 15 years, and both are bound up in a whole host of different trends that I could spend hours entangling and still probably get wrong, but ranging from the sexual revolution, birth control pill, divorce revolution, Roe v. Wade, through various socioeconomic transformations, the information revolution, down through political polarization. There's a whole list of factors, all of which had the effect of weakening religious institutions, and not just religious institutions. You may have noticed that other institutions in American life are having some difficulties as well. But for our purposes, weakening religious institutions, which meant weakening religious authority, which meant weakening the position of anyone who considered themselves a traditionalist, who considered themselves part of a communion with an authority, rather than sort of making their own way as religious individualists or as fully secularized late moderns. And in the aftershock, the last 10 or 15 years, the period that's seen the gay rights revolution, the sort of half-fulfilled transgender revolution, the rise of the so-called nuns, N-O-N-E-S, Americans Without Religious Affiliation, the rise of Donald Trump, the dislocations of the internet, all kinds of turbulences. In this era, I think it's become very easy and at times entirely reasonable for people in the third category, the traditionalist category, to see themselves sort of besieged by an alliance between the other two groups. And this alliance is not, I think, inevitable, because the reality is that the people in that center have a lot of ideas in common with people in the traditionalist camp. There's a reason that my dear friends on Catholic Twitter stand up and cheer in the way one does on Twitter when Marianne Williamson starts talking about metaphysics and the highest good on the Democratic debate stage. They, you know, some of it is silliness, but a convinced Catholic really does have a big chunk of their metaphysical worldview in common with Marianne Williamson in a way that neither of them has in common with a sort of strict materialist or hardcore atheist, right? So there's, and a lot of people in this sort of muddled spiritual center would still describe themselves as Christian and think of themselves as connected to Christian traditions, even if they've drifted away somewhat. So there isn't, it's not inevitable that the middle and sort of the secular wing would ally against the traditionalists, but in practice it seems to happen quite a bit, and mostly because on a lot of core questions, debates about human sexuality in particular, the key overlap between the center and the secular wing, the belief in sort of the inviolability of the individual, the sort of self-mastering, self-reshaping individual, is that that unity is powerful enough to make up for the sort of lack of metaphysical common ground between Oprah and the Harvard, you know, department of X, Y, or Z, just about any Harvard department, really, including sometimes the theology department. No, I kid because I love. So that I think is a, you know, insufficient, like all descriptions, but maybe useful way of framing what's happening, the sort of siege mentality, the feeling of having lost the Christian hold on the religious center, which is a real and accurate feeling, I think, all of which leads to debates like the one framed by your conference title, Fight or Flight. What do you do when you have lost or in the process of losing the culture? Do you retreat and rebuild? Do you find a new way to rejoin the fray, and so on? And without sort of explicitly coming down on the fight side or the flight side, I mean, I don't think anyone's really for the flight. We could get Rod up here and ask him if he's for flight, and he would get very angry at you and tell you that you've misread the Benedict option, which you have, for the record, but he will tell you that, so just be warned. So no one's really for flight, except for the people building seasteadings in the middle of the Pacific, but they don't come to conferences like these. But I think the question of engagement, right, how do you engage, is a challenging one. But I think there are a couple ways, I think it's useful to begin the thinking about it that you'll all be doing, hopefully over the next 72 hours, by looking at some sort of obvious deficiencies in the de-Christianized portions of American culture, and to see in those deficiencies some pretty obvious opportunity for outreach, evangelization, and witness. And I guess, you know, and these deficiencies exist in both the sort of popular center and the sort of secular elite, right? I mean, I think in certain ways you could make a case that Christian revival in the US will come about when, you know, people in the Oprah Osteen, Marianne Williamson world realize, sort of come to the end of their purely individualized spiritual journeys and realize that they need something more, and then you'll have this sort of alliance of the metaphysically inclined against the secular. And that's possible. But I think you could also imagine a world where, as it has at various points, Christianity makes intellectual converts in a new way and sort of leapfrogs the, you know, sort of Christian-ish Oprah Osteen Center and suddenly finds itself making striking gains at, you know, my beloved alma mater, Harvard, or places like that. It sounds implausible, but I don't think it is entirely implausible. So I think, I guess what I'm trying to say is, I think there are deficiencies in both the center and the secular wing that religious people, serious Christians, should be thinking about. And I think, you know, the obvious deficiencies, or the obvious, you might say, weak points among the intellectual elite are the weakness of incoherence, basically. And, you know, no religious tradition is perfectly coherent in every way. Otherwise, Christians wouldn't have anything to argue about, and goodness knows we do. And Christianity places great weight on paradox and mystery as ways to, you know, resolve or not resolve some of our harder questions. But I still think, with that being said, I still think there is a basic coherence, a sort of moral and metaphysical coherence to the Christian world picture that's really totally lacking in the secular world picture right now. The secular world picture. One way to think of it is that it represents a worldview that sort of advanced deeply into de-Christianization, discovered the gulag and the concentration camp waiting there, and didn't like that, and sort of rushed backwards into this halfway zone that jettisons Christian metaphysics but tries to retain Christian morality. And just because that combination is incoherent doesn't mean it can't last for a long time, and I think it's lasted for a while and could last a great deal longer. But it is, I think, there is, I think, a deep incoherence there in the combination of intense moralism, which pervades secular liberalism and pervades it particularly now in the era of what gets described as the Great Awakening or the age of sort of social justice and so on. This is not the worldview of the secular wing of America sometimes gets described by Christians as relativistic, and it's relativistic about a few issues, most of them having to do with sex, but it's not really relativistic in general, and it's, I think, becoming less and less relativistic with every passing day. I think it's impossible to spend any time on any elite campus right now and come away believing that the activist vanguard of progressivism are relativists. They're intense and fervent moralists. They just have their intense and fervent moralism yoked to this, frankly, mechanistic and despairing understanding of the cosmos. And, you know, there are various clever ways to square circles and make this all fit together and invent a Darwinian ethics and get rid of the is-ought problem. And, you know, we could spend a long time digging into that, but I've only got 5 minutes left, so I'm just going to say I don't think it makes a whit of sense. And I think people are effectively aware of that, and that this tension is sort of obvious in, you know, figures like my former colleague and a great writer and a guy I have a lot of respect for, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who's a huge sort of best-selling sage of modern progressivism on race, and who combines this intense moral condemnation and judgment on America, which may indeed be warranted, as moral judgment on all nations is often warranted, with a sort of despairing atheistic perspective on the cosmos, which he himself will sort of describe that way. And it doesn't all quite fit together. And I don't think it's a judgment on his intelligence or seriousness. I think it's a judgment on the broader world picture. It's very hard to make those pieces fit together. And I don't think there's anything right now in the secular worldview that's going to make it all hang together. And I think, frankly, that religious people should look at the religious element in the sort of woke social justice movement and see a hunger, a yearning for coherence and for transcendence and for all the things that the Christian world picture amply supplies. And that doesn't mean that, you know, it doesn't mean that the Great Awakening is going to become a Great Awakening, but it does mean that it probably proceeds from many of the same impulses that have generated Great Awakenings in the American past, and therefore suggests, at the very least, greater possibilities for religious revival in the heart of the secular elite than a lot of people might assume right at this moment. So that's the main weakness in the secular wing and the main opportunity. And then I think you can think about the weakness in this sort of Oprah Osteen middle in two different ways. One is sociological, and one is theological. Not that you can perfectly separate the two. But the sociological weakness is that the sort of spiritual individualism is really bad at institution building. It's really bad at generating community. It's really bad at building Benedict options. And it's striking, you know, that if you look at Great Awakenings in American history, Great Awakenings often include a strong element of religious individualism and freelancing and entrepreneurship and new gurus popping up and so on. But they've historically tended to create, in the long run, institutions and churches, some of them that become fully mainstream, like the Methodists, and some of them that, you know, move to Utah, like the Mormons, and some of them that, you know, become Christian Science, or the Jehovah's Witnesses, or the Seventh-day Adventists, you know, the 19th century America, and some of them that die out, like the Shakers, right? But 19th century America is full of awakenings producing a range of new institutions. And what's fascinating about the 60s and 70s is that it was, in a way, an awakening, a sort of, you know, New Age spirituality, the drug culture, astrology, everything else, that didn't produce those institutions. A figure like Marianne Williamson, right, who is not nearly as influential and important as Oprah, which is why she probably won't be president, whereas Oprah could have been, but is, you know, is a prominent spiritual figure in American life. But she doesn't have a church. There's no sort of Marianne Williamson. There's nothing to Marianne Williamson as Christian Science was to Mary Baker Eddy. And this is true of Oprah herself. It's true of a whole host of these figures. Sometimes they'll have a church or a spiritual realm or, you know, an institution, but generally the kind of institutions and communities that have generated the sociological benefits of religion, the benefits of having a place to go, a place to support your family or support your life or rescue you when you're down, all of those benefits don't come across very successfully in the current highly individualized religious center. And that is a weakness, and it's also an opportunity. It's an opportunity for serious Christians who can build effective, attractive communities to be there for people who are likely to, who are already more alone, more isolated, more prone to depression and suicide in many cases than any population in modern American history, to offer them an alternative, a home, a form of community that the existing spiritual landscape is doing a really bad job of supplying. And this is particularly true, I think, across lines of class, where, you know, the stereotype of the sort of secularized post-Christian American is, again, the upper middle class person, you know, reading, sharing atheist memes on the internet. But the reality is that a huge swath of this sort of semi-religious, spiritual, but not religious population belongs to failing working class communities that right now the existing Christian churches are doing a very poor job of reaching out to. But that doesn't have to be permanent. And it's totally plausible that that zone of American life could become an effective mission field for the traditionalist wing of American religion in really transformative ways. So that's the sociological weakness. But then there's, from a Christian perspective, there's theological weakness as well, right? Which is that, you know, there's a lot of dark stuff out there, I guess, is one way of putting it. The magazine that I used to work for, The Atlantic, a great American magazine, and I'm not just saying this because I'm recommending this piece, it ran a piece recently that sort of looked at the paradox of the decline of institutional religion, the decline of institutional Christianity, the rise of the nuns, the retreat from traditional faith. All of this is happening, and yet the number of people searching out Catholic exorcists keeps going up and up and up. And of course, if the Christian world picture is correct, that shouldn't be surprising in the slightest, right? Because you know, a world of sort of purely individualistic spirituality isn't just dangerous to people's ability to form families and communities and to sort of, you know, carry themselves through the life cycle and build the Tocquevillian society that American sociologists are always waxing eloquent about. It's also dangerous because the spiritual world is kind of dangerous. And if you're out there freelancing on your own, you might come to some pretty dark places that aren't just where the darkness isn't just what you have within yourself. And you know, this is sort of a, it's obviously not a, I guess I'm saying, I'm not sure if it counts as optimism to sort of end by imagining an America, a post-Christian America, plagued by demonic possession. I guess that's not really an optimistic perspective, and I don't want to tell you that it is, but it's optimistic in this sense that, you know, Christians believe that, you know, demons fear nothing more than the name of Jesus Christ. And without using the American language of opportunities and market share, sort of retreating from that language so that I won't be struck down by a thunderbolt, I would just say that reality, it's of course the grounding of all Christian hope and all Christian faith. But I think for an age of de-Christianization, it's a reality that may in many individual lives be brought to a particularly sharp and perhaps frightening, but hopefully ultimately redemptive point. So on that somewhat strange note, thank you all very much. Stay. Okay.
Thank you, Ross.
You're very welcome.
Is this on? We'll just take five minutes, just enough time for a couple of questions before we go to Tony. So we have one mic here. If you do have a question, come up to the mic.
Can I have a show of hands for everyone here who does not know about the Amari-French debate? Who does not? Okay, so very quickly, the Amari-French debate is a debate between two Christian journalists and activists, one the evangelical lawyer David French, the other the New York Post and First Things writer Sourav Amari. And the argument is, in effect, it's sort of in the fight or flight zone, right? With basically, French has been a longtime litigator in religious liberty causes and has basically long made the argument and held the belief that a sort of healthy pluralism and a framework of classical liberalism is the best system in which Christian churches can compete for souls and flourish and so on. And Amari's argument is that essentially classical liberalism bends inexorably towards religious liberalism and you know, will not ultimately be and towards secularism and will not be a respecter of pluralism. And in fact, religious conservatives need a strategy as culturally aggressive and imperialistic in certain ways as the strategy of progressives and secular liberals. I'm not sure both men would perfectly agree with my framing, but that's my attempt. Does that sound right? So, yes, maybe?
Yes.
So where does my argument fit in? I'm sort of ducking, I guess, the political question a little bit. I think that the sort of strategies I'm talking about, to the extent that I'm talking about strategies, intellectual argument, community building, sending an exorcist to every city and town in America, those strategies could certainly be pursued in a context where politically Christians are primarily fighting for religious liberty and defending pluralism and sort of, you know, imagining themselves politically as for the time being, a sort of defensive minority. With that being said, I think, you know, I have where I'm at the very least sympathetic to Sarab's perspective is that I think, one, pluralism is usually sustained not by everyone committing to pluralism, but by different groups all being strong and sort of being in tension with one another. And in that sense, and others, I think, you know, I think Christians need a little more, they need a certain skepticism about some of the places where the existing sort of synthesis of political economy on the right has ended up. And they need some ambition, they need more cultural ambition than just a sort of defense of religious liberty. You're not going to be able to, I think Sarab is right that you're not going to be able to defend religious liberty if you can't persuade a lot of people that the views you're defending are serious and defensible and plausible and not just bigotry, right? You can't just, if somebody calls you a bigot, you can't just say, well, you may think I'm a bigot, but you have to respect my religious liberty. You have to at some point persuade people that what they consider bigotry is actually, you know, a plausible argument or a plausible truth. So in that sense, I think any of my vague proposals for recovery, you know, are compatible with a wider political imagination about how Christianity might be engaged in politics beyond just sort of a defense of the liberty of the church. It's a little bit of a non-answer, but there you go.
Thank you.
Sure. I moderated a debate, just for those of you guys who missed this amazing feat of moderation, between French and Amari, which explains why I'm here ventriloquizing both of their positions and studiously avoiding choosing between them. So, sir.
Totally different question, but the end statement there, we don't really look at sort of mass murders and those kind of things that are happening and seem to be growing as demonic possession, but is that something we could consider as they being possessed to do this kind of evil that happens?
I mean, I want to be very careful and not suggest at all that any particular, you know, I mean, both mass murder and demonic possession are both incredibly serious things that are not, you know, not at all necessarily entangled, except, well, and so I want to be very, I would not ascribe any particular case to the demonic, and I don't think that's necessarily fruitful. But, you know, at the same time, I think if you believe in the demonic, as serious Christians should, you can't discount the possibility. I mean, I think generally what strikes me about American life now is that, you know, for a long time, religious conservatives especially sort of imagined that the decline of institutional religion and the rise of individualism and a lot of the things I've been talking about tonight would lead to sort of social chaos and breakdown and rising crime and so on. And what's striking about the recent era, the last 10 or 15 years, is that unlike the 60s and 70s when there was that kind of breakdown, American society right now is actually quite safe, and sort of the defining vices right now are, you know, sloth in the more theologically acute definition, that sort of it's a society that's sort of aging and losing energy and not reproducing itself and is sort of, you know, it's much more orderly and well behaved, but not in a fruitful way. And then you have these sort of individual spikes of sort of nihilistic mass murder in the midst of this general sort of tranquilized calm. And I don't have a definite takeaway from that, but I just wanted to offer that as a read on the general situation. So one more, yeah. Or two more. Well, I can. I'm here all night. You know.
So you basically said about the second category, I don't know, spiritualism. Like one of the things you said is part of like it might go away because they don't create institutions. But is that an Does that necessarily mean that sort of like the underlying like individualistic, like I don't want to be tied down by an authority, would that go away for the same reason? Or, I mean, because that's been like an attitude in America for, you know, a really long time.
Since the beginning. No, I mean, I think that religious attitude, I mean, one, that it's not just uniquely American, but the American religious landscape has always produced figures sort of animated by that perspective. And I think absent some utter transformation of American life, you're never going to have a world where that kind of individualism isn't part of American life. I do think, though, that it's unusual to not have these sort of spikes of individual entrepreneurship produce sort of institutional legacies. I think that's an unusual thing about the last 40 or 50 years that wasn't true, that sort of the pattern in American history was individualistic churn as people reject hidebound churches, followed by reconsolidation and new institutions, you know, this sort of this cycle. And somehow something broke the cycle, seemingly, in the 60s and 70s, and it's remained somewhat broken since. With some exceptions, you do get, you know, some of the vineyard churches and Pentecostalist churches that emerge out of the 60s and 70s, but that emergence doesn't compensate for the collapse elsewhere. So I guess I'm not, when I say that it could fail, I'm not imagining that the sort of Emersonian, yeah. you know, Emerson and Whitman spirit in American life is going to go away. But I could imagine that many more people could become dissatisfied with it as they experience sort of its fruits across the life cycle, and you could have some turn towards a more communitarian and consolidated practice of religious faith.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. As someone really called to the younger generation, this topic is really on my heart, and I just am wondering how much, or whether you feel that some of the questions that are in the first two, of people in the first two categories, some of the questions that they have are meant to maybe lead us to exploring greater frontiers in our own relationship with God and just expression of Christianity in the world, such as like the New Age crowd and things are searching for within spirituality and the supernatural, as well as racial discussions and so on. Like, how much is it meant to spur us on to find new answers?
I mean, if you take a providentialist view of history, as to some extent I think Christians are obliged to do, then in any period of crisis for the church, you have to see some sort of challenge for, you know, Christianity as it exists. I mean, it's not, you know, the reasons, as I said, I think there's this huge tangle of reasons that institutional Christianity got weaker, but, you know, yeah, I mean, one big reason, as in any period of crisis, are the sins and failings and blind spots of the Christian churches, right? I mean, I'm Catholic, and you know, if it's for anything, the crisis of the Catholic Church around sex abuse is clearly a call for Catholicism and all Christian institutions, because the problem is everywhere, but Catholics in particular, to look anew at, you know, their attitudes, not just towards sexual sin per se, but towards how they think about women and children and family and hierarchy and all of these things. I think on race, one reason among many that Christianity in the U.S. sort of punches below its weight culturally, right? This sort of traditional wing that I'm talking about. If you mapped it onto politics, you might say, all right, you got the secular left, and you've got this muddled Oprah Osteen Center, and you've got the conservative traditionalists. But lots of Black and Hispanic churches fall into the traditionalist wing in religious culture, but are politically liberal. And I think white conservative Christians tend to underestimate the soundness of their reasons for being politically liberal and not just sort of signing up for religious conservatism as it currently exists. So in that sense, yeah, I mean, racial division and racial prejudice has been a besetting sin for American Christians since the beginning. And, you know, in a period of weakness, overcoming those barriers is, I think, an obvious challenge. So I could go on, but yes, I agree, I guess.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.